Good morning and welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Sweet Galby on the board, coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can join us, you can call, you can text. Same number, 855-752-4842. If you're watching on the live stream, thank you so much for joining us. You can leave a comment there as well, and we will see your comments as they come in. Just a reminder, Civic Media is celebrating Dairy Month. June is Dairy Month with all kinds of special stories covering dairy breakfasts in local communities. We have dairy-specific slices of Wisconsin. Get it? Slices of Wisconsin.
See what you did there.
You can find them all at civicmedia.us for all of the stories highlighting our dairy industry all throughout Dairy Month. Again, our website is civicmedia.us. Very excited to have our next guest join us. She is the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Susan Yackey is here. Good morning, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We saw this article a while ago in the Cap Times, and we've been looking forward to talking to you about there is growing interest among students to study public policy. And considering where we are in this country, where it seems like we can't agree on anything, it's just so interesting. What are you hearing from these students?
Yeah, this is happening at UW-Madison in a really big way, and I think it's really exciting. So we're hearing from students that they want to run toward our problems, not necessarily run away from them.
That's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing. Yeah, we are seeing students and actually all across the country investing in public policy education. It's not just here in Wisconsin, but undergraduate majors in public policy have been popping up all across our peer competitors at top universities across the country. And our program here at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison epitomizes that as well. So humongous growth over the last few years.
And what kind of courses are we talking about then, Susan? What things will they be looking at and studying?
Absolutely. So let me tell you just a little bit about our current program and the courses and then kind of our future ambitions as well, because we're seeing more and more student demand for the kind of work that we're doing. So our current program, we offer two different certificates in public policy. And at UW-Madison, those operate kind of like a minor. So you might have a major in engineering, and you would then have kind of a minor in public policy, or our other program is health policy. So, and in those two programs, so they're kind of a shorter course of study because they're more like a minor. Mm-hmm. And those courses offer kind of an entry gateway class where students actually get to vote on the public policy issues that they want to learn more about. So anything from gun violence to inflation to the national debt to foreign policy. And so the faculty member who teaches that class covers some main public policy topics, but also students get a say in the kind of topics that they dig into. And then the remainder of that certificate builds out their skills. And so, for instance, I'll just say here that we offer a class called evidence-based public policy making. And I'll let you ask me a question about that.
Oh my goodness. What? Actual evidence-based, Susan? What? That sounds crazy.
You know, it's exactly what our students are craving, right? So I think in this world now where, misinformation reigns supreme, so many people are, far to the left and far to the right. There is this middle ground where students see value in, doing the work, finding out what kind of public policy programs actually work and trying to invest in those. And that is our kind of the certificate offers two classes a bit like that. So one class is a policy analysis class, which is evaluating what public policies work and what don't work. And then the second class, which is called evidence-based policy making, has students taking in evidence and being good consumers of evidence and then producing reports, data infographics, op-eds, mock congressional testimony, right, or legislative testimony, so that they can practice their skills in communicating data and evidence back to policymakers.
That's great.
That sounds fantastic.
That is great. And I'm so delighted to hear that this is of interest and growing interest among young people, because tragically, they're going to be the next ones who are going to have to deal with all of these things and these issues going forward.
Absolutely. And the certificate programs both have a real world focus. And so the final course, you know, beside those kind of policy topics and the skills-based classes, is an immersive class where the students either do some kind of internship experience that has a wrap around class that helps them understand that internship experience, or they take a class with a faculty member like me doing an applied policy project. So for instance, last year I taught a class where we worked with three sitting Wisconsin state legislators, two Republicans and one Dem. They were all leaders on in the health policy area. And those sitting Wisconsin state legislators, again, two Republicans, one Dem, they came up with the questions for my class. They came up with the research questions that they wanted to see answer in the health policy space. And then my students in this immersive class spent all semester researching those topics, figuring out what do other states doing to address these topics, what have they done well, what do we know, what do we not know, and then at the end of the semester, they produced kind of a short report and then a long report, because we know policymakers like short reports, but they need the long reports too, right? And then they also presented that research at the state capitol. So really wonderful, got a lot of tough questions. Those were, again, undergraduate students at UW-Madison.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, that was my next question for you, is the, you know, taking that education into the internship world, into the real world, getting that experience inside the state capitol as well. Is there any sort of, between UW and the state capitol, do you have sort of a program where it's like, all right, we have an internship program in concert with the state capitol that will allow you to work within the halls and use that policy education to good and put it to good use?
Absolutely. So we're building that right now. And one of the things that we know about our state legislative offices, so La Follette last year interviewed about 80% of our state legislative offices to figure out how can La Follette better serve our state legislature in our quest to be, to live our mission of evidence-based policymaking. And one of the things we heard back, Greg, is exactly what you're saying, is they want to have empowered, smart, skilled interns help them with their work in the state legislature. So we're working right now to try to make that process a lot easier. So thinking through a new website that La Follette will house within the school to make those matches between state legislative members and our students a lot smoother, and figuring out what kind of skills would best serve the different legislative offices. And we're finding that that's just something that on a coordination level, La Follette is better positioned to do, that will then aid our state legislature and our wonderful students as well.
If you're just joining us, Susan Yackey is our guest. She is the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the growing interest among students to learn about policies and policy making. And it sounds, Susan, like part of their studies includes how to do research. How to research, right? And to make sure that, as you said, it is evidence-based.
Absolutely. I mean, that's being a great consumer of research, you know, figuring out, how research was gathered, understanding whether the statistics that come out of that research are worth our time and worth our emphasis, and what we should be lifting up and what we should be not lifting up in terms of evidence, is really, really important in our next generation of public sector, nonprofit sector, private sector leaders. So that is a huge part of our certificate programs. Those programs in the last 5 years have gone from 0 students to 500 students in our certificate program. So yeah, they're in the top 5 or 6 certificates across all of UW-Madison in just 5 years. And so that gives you a sense of that growth. And we are actually in the process, kind of a 2-year process, where 1 year in, of establishing a major in public policy, which would be UW System's first major in public policy.
Are a lot of these kids, and I don't know if they tell you this, Susan, but Are some of these kids thinking about a career in politics? Do they want to go into politics? Is that why they want this kind of background?
Some of them do. Absolutely. So I was chatting, we hosted former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, last fall for a huge public lecture, which was just wonderful. And the speaker, former speaker, met with a lot of our students in advance. And, that was a group that was, probably drawn to him because they're more interested in elected office. But it was a wonderful back and forth where he served as La Follette's policymaker in residence for his time on campus. And he was able to provide that real world, what's it like in the trenches, emphasis on elected office and why people should be choosing elected office. And he was this great ambassador for saying, not only should you be choosing elected office, it's important for public service, but also invest in those data analysis skills. He is a real user of data analysis in his policymaking, or has been in the past.
It just seems like a good idea that if one is planning to go into politics, one would study what would be involved once you're actually in office. That seems like a useful kind of, background.
Skill set. Yeah.
Yes. As opposed to some of our electeds who just don't seem to have any clue. Maybe that's just my perspective.
Real subtle. That's the thing. I mean, for me personally, I love hearing this because I know it's not public policy, but I have a political science degree. And one of the things they tell you is good luck, because it's very tough to get a job in the field of politics, of public policy, if you don't have the right training. And I'm one of the lucky ones who did stumble right in a job in politics. But it's so refreshing and wonderful to see what you're doing, Susan, helping these young people get involved in the process, because not to quote Whitney Houston, but they're our future and they should be informed. And we want to make sure that they have the best ways to research and find the solutions and work together, because I'm sure they all don't agree on the same things either.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually going to be a key part of how we think we're going to innovate in this new major in public policy.
We're going to keep this conversation going. If you could stay for one more segment. Wonderful. Susan Yackey is our guest. We are talking about the increasing interest, yay, in studying public policies. We're going to keep this going. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
By a governing body.
What's your policy?
It can't be vague or foggy.
What's your policy?
It's principles of...
Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, and the Calvinator on the board. You found a song about policies?
It sounded like a song by the most Canadian men ever. What's your policy?
I do think the man is Canadian based off the imagery in the video, but I just typed in public policy song, and this was one of the options.
Susan, now you can bring that into your classrooms, and that is hilarious, actually.
What's your policy? Oh, my God. That's going to be my head for the rest. I'm so sorry.
Susan Yackey is our guest. She's the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and this is an article that we saw in the Cap Times from Jonna Rose Schleiss about this growing interest in public policy at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. And you mentioned something before we went to break, Susan, about they look at different studies in order to come up with some of these analyses. And I think it's important for people to remember that not every study is the same, and not every study is conducted the same, correct?
Absolutely, right? There's such variation in the kind of data that goes into the public policymaking process. And that's one of the things we want all of our La Follette School students, our undergraduates who are doing our certificate, those that are going to do our new major, our graduate students who are fabulous. We want all of them to be wonderful consumers of that, because they're going to be either in the policymaking role where they're going to need to be translating that evidence,
yep,
or they're going to be advising those policymakers at the very senior levels. And we need people to be making decisions based on good evidence.
And something I mentioned just before we went to the break was that not every student in the program has the exact same opinions on everything. And with, do you even offer a class possibly of like how to heal the divide, how to agree without being disagreeable or disagree without being disagreeable and kind of maybe move us forward into a new level of solution making while not fighting, like fighting so heavily and what we're used to today and the news and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. It's one of my real pet projects for the LaFalle School. So, you know, we're this top-ranked public policy school in this very purple state. And so it's terrifically important to us that if our students are going to be impactful, if our researchers and our faculty members at LaFalle are going to be impactful, we have to be within that purple mindset where, you know, bringing people together, not pushing people apart. So there are new major in public policy is actually going to center these issues of the political divide. We did a big look all across peer competitors in the public policy space to find out what are they doing in their curriculum. And our faculty quickly realized that one of the big issues of our times, the issues of polarization, was not being well addressed by some of our peer competitors. So by starting a new program, we get to start it fresh and really tackle the issues of our times. And one of them clearly is polarization. So in our major, which we hope will be approved to start in fall 2025, we have a core class, meaning everybody's required to take it, called Advancing Public Policy in a Divided America. And all the students in our major are going to take this class where they're going to learn about polarization, learn about its nefarious consequences for policymaking, but then also think about what are some of the solutions to polarization. So for instance, the students will do an exercise where they're all assigned public policy topics, and some of them are going to be assigned public policy topics they don't agree with, right? On purpose, right? And they're going to have to do research and evidence collection and articulate arguments about public policy divides that they do not agree with. And actually that's core to our pedagogical, our teaching approach here, is that they are going to be faced in situations in the future where they are debating and working with people that don't think exactly yep. like them yep. on the issues, and have to know how to articulate those issues. We're not trying to change anyone's values. We're not trying to change anyone's positions, but we are trying to make students understand better kind of other points of view, and with the thought that if you understand someone else's point of view, you can actually be better positioned to compromise, but also better able to appreciate other people's points of view.
Susan, I think all of America should be required to take that class. I really do.
I agree. And, you know, our faculty are so committed to it that we're actually this fall, all of our faculty, every single LaFalle School faculty member is going through a training session on talking across difference. We're all going to come together. We're all going to identify, you know, what are some of the skills that faculty members can use in their classrooms. Now, many of our faculty members are very experienced with this already, but all of us can do better and learn better about thinking about ways to integrate in ideas that, you know, may not be in the mainstream, where students may feel like they, you know, they might be wanting to self-censor in ways that we know from the academic classroom is bad for learning, right? So all of our faculty are going to hold this training session that we hope will advance our undergraduate and our graduate training in the future.
Well, and this is something that we talk about a lot just as a network, is how to talk to people with which we may not agree on everything, and learning how to research and learning how to look at data and things like that. That at least gives you something to bring to the discussion that is based in fact, not just emotion. And we all tend, I think, to lean very heavily towards how we feel about something. But then that's great, but that is not a good way to approach policy.
That's right. You know, thinking about and kind of really delineating out what's fact, what's opinion, and recognizing at the end of the day that we can agree to disagree, but can we also find common ground in some spaces? We know that Wisconsinites want us to do this work. So La Follette did a big policy poll of regular Wisconsinites in a year or so ago. And we identified in that poll a lot of areas where Wisconsinites actually have more common ground than you'd think.
Yes.
And so that's a part of our, not just our undergraduate education experience, but also our broader public mission as being an important part of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, is this idea of the Wisconsin idea and sort of bringing people together across, in our case, public policy.
Well, and I think this would be so useful too, even if you're not intending to go into politics or anything. I just think it's a great base for whatever your next step is going to be. I just think it would be really, really useful.
We are expecting a lot of student interest in our programming. And it's not just on the student side. Again, La Follette's going to hold 6 events all across Wisconsin with regular Wisconsinites in September and October in advance of the election, where our faculty are going to be facilitators. They're going to be practicing that talking across difference with Wisconsinites in advance of the 2024 election.
Well, we're going to talk to you before then, because I want to find out when those are happening, and so we can help get the word out if people want to attend. Susan Yaki is the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Thank you so very much for your time, Susan. We really, really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Stay with us. News is coming up next, and then we return. We're going to talk sinkholes.
All right.
We're going to learn stuff. That's all on the way. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you on the Civic Media Radio Network. And beat shoplifting schemes.
What's your policy?
Passed by a governing body.
What's your policy?
It can't be vague or foggy.
What's your policy?
Its principles embodied.
What's your policy?
Well, that is our policy, but it's kind of not our practice. Policy is subject to procedural due fairness. Justice principles should also be in your awareness. Because if you don't, and then you find that you're in an appeal, they...
I'm fixing a hole.
Good morning and welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, and Calvin Butenhoff coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join us. Call or text at 855-752-4842 or leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. Very excited to be joined by our guest. Ken Micah is with the American Society of Civil Engineers, and we're going to talk about sinkholes. Good morning, Ken. Thank you so much for joining us. Ken, I think your mic is muted.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us. The reason I wanted to bring this up, this happened earlier in June. I think it was around June 11th that this big sinkhole appeared in Whitefish Bay in around the Milwaukee area. But sinkholes happen all over the world. So is it always infrastructure related, or what is going on with sinkholes? Why sinkholes?
Sure. So sinkholes can happen both with infrastructure and not with infrastructure. The most general term with sinkholes is usually when water from storm events or flooding gets into the ground, as it naturally does. And if there is potential based on the soil types or the rock that's below, the water will flow through the rock even. You know, as a lot of our groundwater that we use for drinking sources comes from different aquifers. And the movement of the water causes the soil to move. And so you'll naturally get a sinkhole. A lot of times you hear about sinkholes down in the South as well in other states where, you know, you'll hear that the house, like a house went through an entire sinkhole. And that's usually due to a rock formation called karst, where the karst has eroded away. The situation, though, that happened recently in Wisconsin was due to an aging pipe system, where as our infrastructure gets older and we're not able to get to it in a timely fashion to repair it or replace it, we end up getting cracks in certain pipes, and with the cracks and water still going through the ground, through the soil, and whatever else is down there, the water will get into the pipe. And as water flows into the pipe, it's also pulling in the soil as well. And so over time, as more and more soil is pulled into the pipe through the water being going through the pipe, you end up with a sinkhole. And over time, though, you'll have a hole that develops, and eventually the weight of the soil above that hole causes that hole to collapse within itself. And that's how sinkholes generally occur. Well, so it can either come from both regular naturally through soil itself and different rock formations or through infrastructure.
I never thought about the soil actually being pulled into the pipe. That makes perfect sense. I'm just envisioning like an hourglass, right? Where the sand is getting pulled in there. And then, as you said, now you're forming a hole around the pipes. And this just gives an opening, and water will always seek its lowest level. I've been flooded many times. I know all about that.
Mm-hmm. It'll seek its lowest level and it'll take the path of least resistance. And so if there's a quicker path for it to go, it will. And as it continues to erode, it actually takes up more and more and accelerates in its fashion. So a crack might occur, you know, in 1 year, but then by 10 years later, you'll notice that it finally shows up. And that's because, you know, initially it doesn't do much, but over time, as it continues to pick up more and more soil, it causes more and more damage. So,
Ken, if I got any of this wrong, please forgive me. I am not an engineer, but you said one of the things that is that could lead to a house being, you know, swallowed up in a sinkhole is the loss of karst. Is there a way to know whether your house is
sitting on it,
missing it, protected, not protected? This sounds, forgive the dumb question, but can you get karst inserted into your property to help save your house?
Yeah. So karst, there are geologic studies that have been done across the United States. I can't say they're done everywhere in the United States, but there are studies that have been done to try to identify them. Because we do not want to build anything on a karst deposit of that type of soil rock material. Because over time with water, it does erode away. Like I said, mostly seen further south, but there are some areas of Wisconsin where it can be. However, those areas, from my knowledge, are very deep and that they're not a concern to us at this time. But down in the Florida area, down south around the Gulf of Mexico, it's more of a concern down there because there are more shallow. So that's why generally you hear of that happening down south and not up here.
And specifically in Florida, I can think of a number of cases where, yep, that used to be Walter's house and now it's gone. And, or even just with cars getting swallowed up. That's terrifying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yes, you can, there, you generally can find out as long as there was a geological study done in that area. Not all studies are perfect, you know, unless you're going to start poking holes everywhere to see if that is truly there or not. That is a concern. But depending on what infrastructure is even going to be built in an area, the setup, you do have to do, in some instances, a study to confirm whether or not there is karst or potential for karst to be in that area.
Okay, so I did hear that wrong. I was thinking karst was the good thing that protected your house.
No.
Karst is the bad thing. All right, be on the lookout for karst. I see. Okay.
If you're just joining us, Ken Micah is our guest. He's with the American Society of Civil Engineers, and we're talking about sinkholes. After that sinkhole showed up in Whitefish Bay, that was related to some old sewer pipes. But just what causes them in general, and what we can do to protect ourselves. Other than if you're going to build a new house, Ken, it doesn't sound like there's too many options.
No, the reality is up here, if we're seeing sinkholes, the majority of them are going to be from our infrastructure, aging infrastructure, or infrastructure getting damaged in some way or fashion, causing the soil to erode into that piece of that pipe, that duct bank, or whatever it could be for the soil to go, because it's going to go somewhere, and the question is where.
So if we're looking at infrastructure, we're talking about that topic. I don't want to take anything political because infrastructure should never be political. It's infrastructure. But what are the projects that local, state, and federal should be looking at to help protect themselves from these situations? You know, like, are there any things we should be focusing on one thing more than the other in the infrastructure game, or is it sort of an overall deal?
It's an overall deal, I would say, at this point. You know, it is, unfortunately, infrastructure has become a political sense here in the United States, not just Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, our local communities that actually are managing the infrastructure, they're doing the best that they can do. You know, they have limited funding to take care of their infrastructure that it is. You know, a lot of the infrastructure was put in place at a time when materials were a lot less in price, labor was a lot cheaper, and it was a lot easier. Unfortunate side is we have not been able to recover the cost that it does to truly manage our current infrastructure system, whether it is piping networks, whether it's roads and so on. So the best thing for what we can do right now is continue to try to invest and replace and repair when we can. The IIJA in 2021 put a lot of money into the infrastructure industry. However, it was just a little Band-Aid over the bigger problem. And so, you know, I don't want to get into the political side of it, but, you know, that just was a Band-Aid at the end of the day. It did not fix everything. And we'll still see sinkholes happening unless there's a different type of mechanism in place that's going to help, you know, truly pay for the cost that it is to maintain our current infrastructure system.
Well, and continuing to kick the can down the road is not the answer, because these issues are not going to go away. And as you said, Ken, some of these pipe systems are decades old and probably long overdue for being replaced.
Correct. You know, the pipe system that that failed the other week with the sinkhole, from what I understand, that was 90-year-old pipe. Pipe systems are usually generally built and designed for 20, maybe 40 years of service. It really all depends. Most infrastructure is not meant to last 100 years. At least it's not designed to. But we are putting our infrastructure system into a position where we are making it do that, last that long.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some communities that are unofficially admitting on the site, they still have wooden pipes as their water conveyance systems.
Mm.
And, you know, they won't really tell you where they are because obviously there's a lot of concern with that. But we are still relying on old technology in many communities. And so, but the problem is the funding. Where's the funding coming from? You know, and we are paying as individuals of communities, we're paying for our water bills and so on. But what we're the true price that we're paying for our water systems, our wastewater systems, our gas tax and so on, truly does not cover the cost of actually maintaining those systems. And so that's why a lot of the local municipalities for many of their infrastructure systems do rely on the state and federal government to help supplement some of that funding to manage their infrastructure systems.
I mean, what it comes down to is that, you know, this has to be a proactive system. This cannot be reactive. This cannot be where, you know, I don't mean to use the bridge collapse and its infrastructure thing, but like we need to be using these dollars we have, especially at the local level, because I used to work in local government and there were so many times where road projects, they were like, we got to reschedule it because the state or federal took the money away and they're reallocating the funds to this bigger project and our roads crumble more and more. And the thing I hear whenever I hear anyone talk about infrastructure, especially someone like you, Ken, who's an expert in the field, is we need a more proactive look at it rather than either waiting for 90-year-old pipes to burst or getting to them just in time. That's not good enough. We need to have a better plan to take care of these small projects that will make big problems if they're left to be at their own devices.
Absolutely. You know, the big one that's, you know, we talk about in the infrastructure industry is the gas tax. And is it truly a tax or should it be considered a fee in itself? Because the only people that are paying the actual use of the gas are the people that are using gas, no one else. So it's more of a user fee. You don't pay a tax as a citizen and don't go to the state parks. If you're going to state park, you're paying a fee. And so really looking at how our terminology is and how we're paying for things, and having the bigger conversation, do we need to change how we are paying for things and truly bear the cost of it? Would we reconsider then, you know, urban sprawl, as you know, in many communities, would we consider being more urbanized because it's a lot cheaper, a lot more cost effective to stay in an urban setting and to pay those fees? You know, where there's more people, there's a lot more money to pay for the different infrastructure items. Those are conversations that need to be had. I'm not saying it's a good idea for us to get rid of urban sprawl at all. I'm just saying, you know, these are conversations we need to have to truly understand the cost of our infrastructure and how do we maintain it so that we don't have these issues.
Well, and I go back to your saying that there are some small communities that still have wooden pipes that are 100 years old. I mean, if those fail, not only is that going to be catastrophic, but as Greg kind of implied too, you are doubling and tripling the cost of fixing this infrastructure now, if we allow it to get to that point, correct?
That is correct. So every time it fails, it costs more money to go in with the failed infrastructure than it is to go in and replace it. So, because most of the times when something fails, you're going in with people that are, you know, getting called in late at hours or whatever it might be. So the price tag just went up.
And
going in not knowing 100% and not having a design and having to figure it out on the fly costs a lot of money too.
Not to mention on top of the fact you have to fix whatever's damaged. Like on top, like not just the pipes, but did it break concrete? Did it hit a car? Did, you know, there are so many variables that, once again, infrastructure should never be political. This just makes sense. Let's just fund it, keep ourselves safe, and save the money in the long run. It's an investment.
Absolutely, it's an investment. Yeah. How does Wisconsin look overall, Ken, as far as the state of its infrastructure?
Well, that's a great question, because Wisconsin's going to be releasing, or the ASC Wisconsin Group is going to be releasing the 2024 report card on September 17th, where we're going to be reporting again on where Wisconsin's infrastructure is and where it's going to be going.
Okay.
And so stay tuned for that, because we're excited. We're going to be reporting at least on, it looks like, about 16 chapters. And we're also not just covering the general pipes, wastewater, roads, bridges, transportation, but we're actually going to be bringing in broadband this year as well.
That's important.
That's really important.
Oh, yep. That's wonderful.
So we're going to be touching base on a lot of things Wisconsinites want to know. Past reviews of Wisconsin's infrastructure, you know, it was ups and downs. You know, transportation, roads, and bridges could have been better. There's a lot of areas that could have been better. But we also had some good areas as well. So don't want to shortcome, you know, what's coming out. But we're excited to be giving the citizens of Wisconsin an update on where the infrastructure is at.
Well, we're going to get you back on in September once you guys release that that report. And you can give us an update on where we are infrastructure-wise. Ken Micah is with the American Society of Civil Engineers. It's been so interesting, Ken. Thank you so very much for joining us. And we will talk to you in a couple months.
Thank you very much. Glad to attend.
Appreciate it. Stay with us. One more segment to go before the news, and then Todd Alba from noon to 2 p.m. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, the Calvinator on the board. Coming to you from sunny downtown Waukesha. It is a beautiful day. If you have the chance, get out and enjoy it. It really is lovely. And give us a call or shoot us a text at 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and the platform that Elon continues to actively ruin. Just finished up our conversation with Ken Micah from the American Society of Civil Engineers after that sinkhole showed up in Whitefish Bay earlier this month. And look, Greg Bach, there's more infrastructure talk.
Yeah.
I-94's planned expansion on Milwaukee's west side. This is from Tom Dakin in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's a $1.74 billion six-year project. So they're going to have some public meetings about this. There's all kinds of different opinions about this. The open house meetings set from 4 to 7 p.m. One is tomorrow at the Washington Park Senior Center at 44th and Valete. And the Wednesday meeting will be at State Fair Park's Tommy Thompson Youth Center on 640 South 84th Street in West Dallas. So if you live in the Milwaukee area, and particularly on the west side, and this will be affecting you because this is going to have some wide-ranging impacts, you may want to attend one of these two meetings, and we'll get the links to this article in our show notes if you want to attend. You're gritting your teeth, Greg Bach. What?
I am so angry right now about this. I don't know much, so maybe they'll put my mind at ease, but I was under the belief that 94 was done, that the long project that took 10 years was it.
You mean the whole zipper, going back to the zipper merge and all that stuff?
Expanding the freeway lanes and clean, and getting new, like the whole, I thought we, this is a nearly $2 billion project, which, by the way, I'm just going to put it out here. A six-year project around the Brewer Stadium. So not only will you have traffic during the stadium, during baseball, but then you have construction on top of traffic. I want to know why. I really truly want to know why the money's being used for what. What is the and in this I see expansion of 6 to 8 lanes.
Yes, between 16th and 70th.
I need to know why, and maybe I'll go to the meeting because I this really upsets me because I was under the impression that this was done.
Yep, the project centers on widening I-94 from 6 to 8 lanes between 16th and 70th streets. From my opinion, from 35th to 16th, they should leave it alone. The speed limit there right now is 50.
Yes.
No one goes 50. People are going 70. If we expand those lanes, now they're going to be going 90. And I don't sit in rush hour traffic. That's not the way I travel. So if you do, I'm sure it's a pain in the neck. But I don't see how this is going to completely solve this issue. And in another 20 years, they're going to want to widen it from 8 to 10.
Well, and that's the other thing is if you think of, you know, for folks out there who don't know Milwaukee well, we apologize. We're talking very nuanced roads here. But if you think about 35th to 15th on 94, where's the space coming from?
Right.
Because it's not like it's sprawling like on 94 heading southbound. You have all this
land.
Property and mm-hmm. land. But 35th to 15th, it like sort of almost juts out.
Well, McKinley's right there.
Yeah.
McKinley's right there on the north side, and Valley is right there on the south side.
Again, maybe I can go to the meeting, or we have someone on here who can hold my hand and say, take a breath, Greg. It'll be okay. But so much of this really just upsets me, especially that $2 billion price tag, because one, we know that means $4 billion.
Yes.
We also know 6 years means
10.
8 years, or it's just the continuation, because let's also be honest, that 10-year project from 2010 to 2020 took until about 2022 to completely finish then, and they're still doing work. I mean, they're doing 894 right now, and that thing is just a mess. It just never ends.
Well, and talking about infrastructure, I mean, obviously some of these things have to be updated. And
yes, absolutely.
It is a continual thing, and especially because of our weather here and the freezing and thawing cycle, and this all plays into it too. But Wisconsin DOT says they have to increase the lanes from 6 to 8 to reduce congestion and improve safety. And I just don't see how this is going to improve safety when all it's going to do is make it easier for people to blast in and out of traffic and weave in and out of traffic when they're going 70.
We are also not a state, and this was proven to me personally, unless there's an accident or a snowstorm, that 4 lanes on the freeway heading southbound on 94, we are not such a populous state where that was necessary. We're not LA, we're not Chicago, we're not Atlanta, we're not New York.
Houston.
We don't require so much lane, you know, expansion that it somehow fixes the trick. It's just, we're, you know, this doesn't make any sense to me. And I swear to God, and I hate, this is all lobbying to me. This is all lobbying to me.
The Sierra Club and other opponents say the project benefits suburban commuters over black and brown people who live near the freeway. They also say this project will bring increased air and water pollution and other harmful impacts that will disproportionately affect people of color. Wisconsin DOT says it continues to minimize harmful effects. The review could result in the DOT taking additional action to mitigate harmful impacts. Again, if you live in the city of Milwaukee and you're interested in this, they're going to have 2 open house style meetings about expanding I-94 from 16th Street to 70th, going from 6 to 8 lanes. The meetings, one is tomorrow from 4 to 7 at the Washington Park Senior Center on Valete, and Wednesday's meeting will be at State Fair Park's Tommy Thompson Youth Center in West Dallas, and we'll get the link to the article. This is from Tom Dakin in today's Journal Sentinel. We will get that up in the show notes after the show is over. All right, we have news on the way next. Thank you to Greg and Calvin and our engineers. Without you guys, absolutely nothing works. And most of all, thanks to you for calling and texting and, above all, listening. It absolutely means everything. I hope you find some joy today and you have the chance to share it. Watch the weather tonight. Be careful. And we'll be back with you tomorrow. Keep it here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Have a great day.